dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, one of the great sources of, well, both common sense as well as great reporting and intelligence in the open sense of the word, is the Latin American Herald Tribune. Its president and editor-in-chief is Russ Dallin. He's also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets, and a journalist of some renown, among other qualities. We are always privileged to have him with us to talk a bit about the countries in his portfolio, most especially Venezuela, which has been such a terrible problem for so long for its own people as well as for the region. It's good to have you back. Russ Dallin, thank you for joining us. Let's talk a little bit about an important development in the past few days and whether it might make a material difference on the ground in Venezuela. And that is that the United States government has formally charged Nicolas Maduro and I believe 14 of his cronies with an extraordinary crime. Tell us about it.
They have indeed. Maduro, Nicolas Maduro, who is the head of the regime there, although not recognized by the United States, which is why I have been told by State Department that they were not charged with being state sponsors of terrorism because they are not recognized as the head of state. Otherwise, they would have been charged with that as well. But at any rate, Maduro and 14 of his cronies, including two members of the FARC from Colombia, were charged in a wide-ranging series of indictments that some were filed in Miami, some in New York, some in Washington, with drug trafficking, money laundering, and basically seeking to, and this is literally, flood the United States with drugs and cocaine as a weapon.
I think it was called, at least in one of the charges, as narco-terrorism. And the object of killing Americans really has made this personal now, not just sort of an abstraction in terms of what a blight on the hemisphere, as well as the people of Venezuela and Maduro and his regime have been. So, Russ, is there any prospect? Obviously, he's not voluntarily going to turn up in federal court to face these charges. Might it intensify the pressure for his removal in Venezuela that he's got, I believe it's a $25 million bounty on his head now?
That's correct. Well, he personally is only worth $15 million. I think Osama bin Laden was a 25 million head. And by the way, Attorney General Barr, who made these announcements and presented these indictments with the attorney, the district attorneys, or for each of the different regions, also chiming in by remote, as we have to do things in this day of coronavirus, made a point of both charging Maduro and explaining a little bit about the suits, but also when he was asked whether it was a dead or alive kind of thing, he didn't really answer it. He basically said, we want him to be tried and pay for his crimes, which I suppose was his diplomatic skills.
Well, look, dead or alive seems to me to be the order of the day. If he's been killing Americans, that does not seem to be something we should rule out. Let me ask you, in your paper, the Latin American Herald Tribune, you reported on one of the steps that this regime of Maduro's has taken in response to the coronavirus that has got a lot of people thinking that it has less to do with contending with the pandemic than it does with contending with his political opposition.
It's a toxic mix of everything, Frank. It's one, he is using it to crack down on the opposition. He's released these motorcycle gangs that they arm and buy motorcycles for and give money and liquor to. It's, you know, life is cheap in Venezuela at the moment. Called Colectivos is the name of these motorcycle gangs. And they have been going around terrorizing. If anyone is on the streets, they go around and terrorize them, attack them. They killed three people playing dominoes in the street last week. At the same time, there's no gasoline. So he's also using some of these sort of stay-at-home measures to force people to not be able to get gasoline. And he's closed essentially all the gas stations because there literally is no gasoline, which is Margaret Thatcher's, what is socialism is, you know, they'll run out of sand in the desert if the socialists are in charge of it. And that's essentially what happened. The country with the largest oil reserves in the world is now out of gas.
It's unbelievable. And unfortunately, I guess, Russ, as long as this regime is in place, there's really no end in sight, is there? There's no likelihood that that enormous natural wealth in terms of oil would be exploitable and the economy, as a result, once again restored to something approximating good health, let alone the people of the country. Where do efforts by the Russians, for example, to sort of step in and to try to help the Venezuelan regime, you know, get access to those oil reserves stand, and the prospects more generally?
Well, interestingly, on Saturday, Rosneft made a very surprising announcement. Rosneft is the state-controlled, majority-owned by the state oil company that produces about 5.8 million barrels per day, very powerful, got involved heavily with the Chavez and then Maduro regimes, owns five joint ventures there. They announced that they were pulling out of the country. In February and March, the United States had put sanctions on two specific subsidiaries of Rosneft, Rosneft Trading, as well as TNK Trading, which had been buying the Venezuelan oil at $20 off a barrel, and basically reselling that for profit because no one would buy it from Venezuela. So the United States quite smartly sanctioned Rosneft Trading, not Rosneft the big firm itself, which is traded on the Moscow and London stock exchanges, but these subsidiaries that were basically stealing from the poor Venezuelans, because the Venezuelans were so desperate and the sanctions on PDVSA were preventing them from selling to a lot of people who wouldn't touch it. The sanctions worked and Rosneft has pulled out because it is a company that trades on the stock exchange. So the other aspect of that is that they have given it to a state-controlled company, however. So Rosneft itself will now be the Venezuelan entities were traded for about 9.6% of Rosneft's shares, which is about $3.9 billion in stock from Putin to Sessions' company. And in exchange, they gave them to a Russian, now 100% owned company. So it will be out of reach sort of our sanctions. And we're waiting to see what the next chess move from Putin is. Is he going to let it die? Or is he going to sell it off? Or are they going to run it and, you know, continue to support the Maduro regime?
Yeah, circumvent the sanctions. My guess is that circumventing the sanctions will be the preferred course of action for Vladimir Putin, even at the low price of oil that he and the Saudis have engineered, to the great detriment, of course, of our fracking industry. Russ Dallin, there's going to be a lot more to cover here, and you will be doing it splendidly at the Latin American Herald Tribune. We look forward to visiting with you about it in the near future. Thanks for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll get into the coronavirus in this country and elsewhere right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by one of the country's foremost experts on China and our vital national security and, well, now increasingly public health implications of the relationship with Communist China and the party that misrules it. He is Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books, Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea. You can find his writings in various places, The Daily Beast and National Interest among them. You often see him at Fox News, and we're always delighted to have him as a featured guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Gordon Chang, welcome back. Good to have you. I want to encourage our listeners to follow you at your Twitter handle, Gordon G. Chang, and otherwise to take aboard as much as possible your insights, Gordon. You did a marvelous job on Tucker Carlson's show, as I recall, the other night, and we're always grateful for your appearances here as well, specifically in the midst of this pandemic. And I was thinking of you as I was listening yesterday to Deborah Birx talking about the degree to which the United States government was misled by what the Chinese initially said about the nature of this disease and its, well, threat to humanity. Were you surprised somewhat by that, or was this what we've all really been induced to recognize about the Chinese, namely that they lied then and, well, that they're lying now?
Yeah, her comment was extraordinary because it's not something that you hear leaders of a Western country talk about. And for her to say that from the podium at the White House really showed a change of view. I think that, you know, many people have dark views of Chinese communism, but we got to remember that scientists and often just talk to other scientists in countries, and they don't get the dark sense of the political system when they have people-to-people contact. But we got to remember, and her comments highlight this, that it's not so much the Chinese people, but it's the nature of the Chinese political system that has forced virologists, epidemiologists, all types of scientists and people in China into taking positions that endanger others. And that's exactly what happened here.
There's reason to believe, Gordon, is there not, that the data that the Chinese are supplying even now in terms of the number of lives lost or others that have simply been infected with the disease are wildly understated, prompting, you know, among other things, headlines about how much worse the disease is here, especially when there's talk now that we may suffer as many as 100 to 200,000 deaths. When the Chinese have only had 4,000, that seems remarkable, to say the least.
Yes, well, the numbers that Beijing is reporting on new infections are particularly interesting. So, for instance, if you go back 3 weeks ago, they were reporting numbers in the low single digits of new infections. Now they're talking about dozens a day. The last number, I believe, for yesterday was 36. The day before that, maybe 47. And what is also fascinating is they're saying that virtually all of these cases are imported, quote unquote. That means it's generally Chinese nationals returning to China because they think that things are better in China. What Beijing is saying is that over the last 2 weeks, there's only been three in-country transmissions. And that is just incredible. When you think it's a country of 1.4 billion, we know a lot about what the virus has done in other countries. We look at the modeling that people have done for China and just things that we can see. So, for instance, we see China starting to close down its theaters and its attractions and all sorts of things. And that can't possibly, those two things just can't possibly be true at the same time. So China has actually continued to mislead the international community about the situation inside the country.
And presumably, to some extent, they're misleading their own people. For example, Gordon, if they're shutting down movie theaters and other events, it has to be a problem for them that they have workers in these factories, many of them living in crowded dormitories, when they're insisting that it's safe to go back to work. Is that not likely to also be a problem?
Yeah, well, definitely. Where there already is evidence of worker-to-worker transmissions as workers have returned to job sites, then these Chinese who have been returning to China because they think that the situation is clear in China, you know, is an indication. So that we have this migration back into the country. And that is the result of propaganda that even cynical Chinese believe it. So Chinese propaganda does work, Frank, and it's now resulting in all sorts of additional infections and deaths around the world.
It's a case that I'm fond of saying, Gordon, reminds me of the old narrative about George W. Bush. In this case, China lied and people died. And we're going to see more of that, I'm afraid, as this propaganda persists. Speaking of which, Gordon, one of the narratives that the Chinese have been promoting, as you know, is that not only is communism a cure for the coronavirus, you know, their way of handling this is proven to be highly effective and everybody else should emulate it, but also that they are now generously making available to nations around the world medical equipment, tests for the virus, and the like. Talk about the actual nature of those transactions and the quality of the things that they are supplying.
Well, China started this with Italy saying that it donated equipment to that country. But really what it did was it sold equipment to Italy. What we have found is that Chinese diagnostic kits were 80% inaccurate. Masks that were sold to the Netherlands were defective and were returned. So we're seeing this. And this is largely a result because China has gotten factories around the country to go into mass production where they never did that before. And so we have seen, just apart from coronavirus and epidemics, defective products, adulterated products from China, where people, including Americans, have died. So, for instance, heparin in 2008. And now we're seeing that on a massive scale. And by the way, Frank, is this narrative of China lied, people died, is absolutely correct. We have 4,000 dead Americans now to prove that, because Beijing tried to get the world to not impose travel restrictions on China. They did that in January and February. At the time, they knew that the virus would be transmitted human to human, but they denied that. And by trying to force countries to keep their borders open, this virus did spread around the world. And of course, it spread to the United States, as we heard Dr. Brix talk about yesterday. So this was malicious. China's leaders either knew or should have known that this would result in deaths of Americans. So China lied and people did die. And many of those people, Frank, are Americans.
And many more may yet before this is over, needless to say. Gordon Chang, let me ask you, want to engage in a bit of a thought experiment. I'm going to be talking about this with our two subsequent guests as well. The Chinese, some have suggested, may have actually engineered this disease as part of a biological warfare program that either accidentally released it or perhaps purposefully did. The evidence is not available to support that at the moment. But Gordon, if you were able to put yourself into the seat of the Chinese Communist Party leadership under Xi Jinping, would you not be looking with great interest at how this thing is playing out, given that we're told a general by the name of Qi Haoquan, 2 decades ago, apparently told party cadre, according to J.R. Nyquist in a piece that appeared in the Epoch Times two months ago, that there is actually a biological weapons program that was put into place by then General Secretary Deng Xiaoping for the purpose of eliminating the U.S. population and enabling China to colonize the United States. Now, that sounds crazy, of course, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't the plan, or it isn't a capability that is present now. And is it possible that the Chinese are simply looking at this now, at the very least, whether they engineered it or not, as a proof of concept of how effective a biological attack against this country might be?
I'm sure the Chinese are looking at that. Frank, people will say biological weapons are not practical. But we have seen with the coronavirus epidemic that they are practical and that they can hobble an opponent. China is a party to the Biological Weapons Convention, which prohibits the maintenance of biological stocks for the purpose of weaponization. But there is no verification of this. There's no verification mechanism. And I think that we should be pulling out of that convention unless Beijing opens up its facilities, including the one in Wuhan, to international inspection. Because here, this is another treaty which sounds good, looks good, but it actually is very destructive, because I don't know if China has biological weapons or not, but there's a lot going on in that lab. They tell us that they've stored 1,500 varieties of coronavirus. We need to see what's there. I don't believe that this COVID-19 was engineered. At least the science doesn't support that. But that doesn't mean that this bug wasn't released from that lab accidentally, because there is some evidence to suggest that it was, because not all the science supports the notion that this started naturally at that wet market in Wuhan, 20 miles north of the lab. We need answers, Frank. And unless China opens up for inspections, we need to get out of the Biological Weapons Convention.
It's a very important point, Gordon, because it does give us, at the very least, a full sense of security that this danger is now being managed, and that's not so. And more to the point, we're watching, I'm afraid, evidence, even this relatively non-lethal disease, let alone ones that, if engineered, could be unleashed upon the world. It can have on a country like ours, where it's terrified our people, it's devastated our economy, and it's even marginalized and sidelined our military. Very ominous things indeed. Gordon, we appreciate, as always, your insights into such matters, as well as the clarity with which you describe what we need to do about them. Thank you for joining us here. I hope that our audience will join you at Gordon G. Chang, and of course, for our visits with you next week. In the meantime, keep up the splendid work, my friend. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman about the costs specifically to the economy, about this pandemic, and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with the master of the economic war room. His name is Kevin Freeman. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy with a specialization in economic warfare matters, but he is also the host of Blaze TV's program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is a man of great accomplishment, notably with two extraordinarily important and indeed very timely books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is also a very considerable contributor to the public policy debate through his blogging at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin Freeman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you with us. I'm particularly interested in sussing out an idea, Kevin, that we could talk a little bit about with Dinah West in a moment, Gordon Chang, before you, but I wanted to get your take on it. The jury is still out, and let me be very clear about that, but Senator Tom Cotton has been warning for some time that what we have been experiencing in terms of this coronavirus, or I think more accurately, Chinese Communist Party virus, could have been precipitated by the biological warfare program of Communist China. And having said that the jury's out, I wanted to see, from your perspective, given what's happened in the aftermath of this pandemic arriving on our shores, it certainly would look as though, whether it was by design or not, whether it was actually engineered for this purpose or not, the effect could be one that certainly proves the effectiveness, the lethality, the damage that can be done by a biological attack against the United States, in particular against our people and economy. Your thoughts?
Well, there's no way that I could know, and I'm sure that the experts are looking at it, the origin of the virus, whether it was accidental or whether it was purposeful and man-made. And the jury is out on that, there's no question. But the impact, the ability, the proof of concept is very real. For example, a tiny virus that gets out can devastate the world's largest economy. It can do things that an impeachment hearings and everything else couldn't do. It put, you know, in literally putting the election in question. And really, the basis of it is, and there's this cartoon that was in China Daily on March 20th, under the headline, Virus Kills Markets, there is a smiling coronavirus with cowboy hat on, with a cigarette in his hand, with a gun smoking, and on the wall is a bull's head that says stock markets. And the virus is smiling. He's just so happy and content that the stock markets have been killed, knowing that hurts President Trump's reelection, regardless of the fact that it's killing people, that's causing human devastation, that it's sending people into the unemployment lines, everything else. The virus is smiling, and that's what China Daily, which is the Communist Party's English language newspaper, is really touting, that their little virus killed the market.
And the question, I guess, is, are the Chinese communists smiling as well? The suggestion certainly is that that might be the case. Kevin, you've been writing about the impact on the economy. The effects have been, to some extent, forecast, interestingly enough, by none other than George Soros. Talk a little bit about some of the warnings that he was issuing back in January and how they seem to have come true with a vengeance.
Yeah, well, it was late January. He was in Davos. It was reported in CNBC. So I guess it's January 23rd, just barely over 2 months ago. And the headline, George Soros warns Trump of potential economic doom. And in the headline, he says, well, the stock market may be doing well, but it's a little early. If it happened later, it would have reassured his election. Then he has this curious line that says his problem is the elections are still 10 months away, and in a revolutionary situation, that's a lifetime. And then he goes on and says, Soros said Chinese President Xi Jinping is trying to exploit Trump's weaknesses. When you put all that together, it remarkably prescient, unbelievably prescient.
You know, it calls to mind the fact that globalists like Soros and, you know, fellow travelers with the Chinese communists were active in a dress rehearsal, if you will, a tabletop exercise, I think it's been called Event 201 in October of 2019, well before those Soros warnings, but where you actually saw a coronavirus pandemic experimentally wargamed for the purpose of demonstrating how global governance could be advanced in the chaos that would ensue. It seems incredible that all of this is purely coincidental, but we are going to continue to tease it out. Let me ask you, if this were by design and the effects are, as we have seen, quite debilitating to both the United States military, notably the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt at the moment, which is in port in Guam, because it's got lots of sick sailors in its crew, and there's a kind of panicked effort underway to try to contain that damage. But there seems to be, at least reportedly, a likelihood that an awful lot of other military installations and defense industrial base facilities, Kevin Freeman, may also be among the casualties in this pandemic's rage. What might one, again, take away, whether one has engineered this for the purpose or not, if you were in the Chinese Communist Party headquarters, for example, as to the utility of biological warfare?
Well, the takeaway is that it's highly effective. This is a virus. It's a coronavirus. It's you know, in compared to some other deadly diseases, it is fortunately not as deadly as Ebola and things like that. But it just proves that something that's highly transmissible, which is this is, that can be transmitted when you don't necessarily show symptoms, so it spreads very, very easily, would be an ideal biological weapon. You can destroy an economy and a military both. And you can do it very rapidly. I mean, we're only talking 2 months since George Soros was talking about how great the economy was. And biological weapons, you know, they're forbidden. They're not supposed to be something we don't use, but they're very real. They're very powerful. And this is proof that they can work. And now we have some real legitimate questions. I don't know why there isn't a push, a very strong push, to get in with the international experts to see if this was a bioweapon that was either accidentally leaked or purposely planned. You know, not laying blame, it's just we're talking, the stakes are so incredibly high that if one rogue nation were to develop this, you know, maybe not China, but what if North Korea or what if Iran used something like this? It's just really powerful, and it's something that the world needs to pay attention to.
Amen. Kevin, let me ask you about one other individual who I think is prominently positioned to exploit this pandemic crisis. He's a globalist master of the universe, as they've been called on Wall Street, these financial types that you've trafficked with in your long and illustrious career as a chartered financial analyst. His name is Larry Fink. Talk a little bit about Fink's current status and the kinds of agendas that he's advanced to this point and the position that he might now be in to advance even more dramatically going forward.
Well, Frank, you wrote an excellent piece on this, which was title of "You're the Rat Fink, Investment Firm Selling Out of America." Larry Fink at BlackRock is a master of the universe is too small a term. When I was at Templeton, we were thrilled when we got our first $1 billion under management in my division. The entire organization managed $100 billion. Larry Fink is overseeing, well, it's likely less now, but $7 trillion. More than we're putting in our stimulus package, you know, a huge percentage of our GDP, huge percentage of the world's GDP. He is the world's largest investment manager. And what he is doing is he's promoting not getting the best possible return for your investments, but making sure that you meet politically correct criteria of environmental, social justice, governance. And at the same time, while he's holding American companies accountable to this left-wing politically correct agenda, he's wanting to invest as much as possible in China and grow his business as much as possible in China, which doesn't care a whit about the environment or social or governance.
No, to the contrary. It's antithetical to all of them. And so when you look at the idea that a fellow who's got this radical left-wing agenda, Kevin, on the one hand, and has been deeply involved in enriching the Chinese Communist Party by transferring, not single-handedly, but significantly, something on the order of $3 trillion worth of money from our capital markets to the Chinese Communist Party's companies. We've got that guy now entrusted with a leading role in deciding how the stimulus funds are going to be allocated to struggling American companies, and even more ominous, a management role in the $4 trillion that the Federal Reserve has recently been given for the purpose of trying to help resuscitate the economy. This would seem to be a very dubious guy to entrust all of that to.
It is the fox in the hen house, right? It is the person that is potentially a threat to constitutional liberties, to good economics, managing a company with the purpose of providing the best possible return to shareholders, obeying the law, wanting to be moral and so forth. But he wants to subordinate those issues. He wants to use taxpayer money and other people's money to achieve what he believes the remake of the world should be. That sounds an awful lot like our friend George Soros we talked about earlier.
It does indeed. And we're all very skeptical of Soros. Larry Fink is arguably a much more serious problem even than he. This to be discussed further. Kevin, we are out of time. Thank you for your visit with us today. As always, we're delighted to chat with you and for the great work that you do at Economic War Room on Blaze TV. Find out how you can subscribe at economicwarroom.com. We'll talk with you again next week, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West and visit with her about some of these same subjects and more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our weekly visit with the fabulous Diana West. Diana is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist who blogs these days at dianawest.net, the author of three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, the search for ideological drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy. Diana, it's so good to have you with us. We've been talking in the course of the program about the coronavirus and its implications. I wanted to sort of take stock with you on a backstory that, to my way of thinking, is still not getting sufficient attention, and that is what this whole episode has really showcased for us about the nature of the Chinese Communist Party and its propensities. There's no question about it now that the fact that it lied early on in the course of this pandemic made it vastly worse, and Americans are dead as a result, among many, many others around the world might say, to paraphrase the old Democrat Bush narrative, China lied, people died. This isn't really surprising as a student of totalitarian regimes like the Chinese Communist Party, is it?
No, it's not a surprise. It is part and parcel of how communist dictatorships control people, control their countries, their populations. They use information as a weapon, and they of course they lie to further the agenda of the party. Now, saying that, I would say that we are seeing a mirror image of that in terms of control of information, manipulation of information in the Western world, because I don't feel I'm getting a clear story on what's going on. And I would say that every scare headline in our media, going from, you know, the Daily Mail all the way around the world and to any press, you know, you'd like, to the New York Times across the ocean with every country in between, we are not getting context. We are not getting investigation of the effects of the shutdown. We are getting scare tactics in terms of protecting our health. However, this becomes a question, you know, as you bring this up in terms of how a communist society uses information, we are being manipulated by the purveyors of information coming from the government and the media into certain behaviors. So this is not unique to communist societies. And I would say that as I worked through my book, American Betrayal, which in a sense is a history of the big lie in the 20th century, which in terms of harnessing mass media, which was a new thing in the early 20th century, and this government controlled by a dictatorship, in this case, Stalin, Lenin and Stalin in the Soviet Union, they were the first to create this melding of mass media and fake information to manipulate populations, not only their own, but the rest of the world. And this is something that was quickly embraced across the globe back in the 1920s, 30s by Western governments as well. So we see this tendency when governments seek to control their citizens. And what we are watching with the corona threat to our health, we're also watching a greater threat, in my opinion, to our political health, to our political liberties. And this is where you see this terrible synergy between a communist dictatorship and the impulses and the inroads that this ideology has made across all of our societies.
You know, Diana, I did a thought experiment yesterday in my commentary and talked a little bit about it on the program as well. If the Chinese were not actually responsible for unleashing this disease, coronavirus 19, as it's been called by some, I think the Chinese Communist Party virus is a better way to describe it, by design as an act of biological warfare against the West. And I think the jury's out on that. I'm not saying that it happened. I'm just saying we don't know whether it did or it didn't. But just for the moment, set aside that possibility. What definitely has eventuated, and you've just talked about some of the effects, the devastation of our economy, the terrorizing of our people, and one might add also the sidelining of our military. All of these are the kinds of things, to say nothing of, you know, getting more countries to behave more like, you know, the communists in terms of control of their people. This is presumably a pretty good outcome for the Chinese. And the question occurs at a minimum whether they are taking away from this the idea that a more lethal biological attack in the future could produce even more desirable effects.
Absolutely. No, it's spectacular for China, which was really on the ropes ever since Donald Trump began to enact his economic and manufacturing and nation-building agenda. So that is a true thing. The results, however, are in some ways more staggering when you see this lockstep across our country, across the free countries of the world, where governments and right down to police have used this, well, for some, a genuine concern, and for others, it seems a pretext to encroach on our most basic liberties. And indeed, I mean, this is getting to a very micro level where they are messing with our psychology, our mental health, in terms of this vice that is coming down on our activity to a point where a surfer gets a ticket. There's obviously no health risk here, but the beach has been shut down. Oh my goodness, the fishermen are not allowed to fish. In England, you have people getting bored with quarantine, taking a drive and being ticketed by police. So you see the totalitarian impulse awakened right down to the sort of police level, the local authority level. Where does that leave us? Where will that leave us on the other side, whatever the other side is to look like? An anecdote from the wilds of New England, a plumber is on his way to work yesterday and gets pulled over and asked where he's going, what he's doing, is it essential business? Well, actually, a stuck drain turns out still to be essential business. However, consider this is America. What has happened to us? How is it possible that this continuum of really very communistic, totalitarian force is now being deployed against the people, and really will be driving many of us to distraction, if not worse. And then, of course, there's the economic wasteland to come that we will be walking through at some point. So this is very alarming. And then when you constantly see this fear being driven to panic people, not to inform them, I don't feel informed by the media. I feel panicked by them. It's very hard. And anytime there's an outlier a story, you see, I don't know if you've watched what's happened with the American Thinker in Peter Chalka's reporting on Dr. Fauci, but he has been, for presenting alternate information, actual factual information, he's been utterly under siege by the New York Times, Politico, the Washington Post. They don't want to hear anything that deviates from the narrative, and that's when you know that they are deceiving you and that this is a mind game more than anything else.
I haven't tracked that story about the American Thinker, but it's instructive. And part of the force that's operating here clearly is the Democratic Party's very aggressive utilization of this crisis and not letting it go to waste, as Rahm Emanuel famously said, to drive their messaging. And this is being done through some of their media outlets, most obviously. But Diana, I did want to ask you, the president was encouraged to ruminate yesterday in his press conference about whether the impeachment may have taken his eye off the ball at a critical moment in the run-up to this pandemic. And he allowed as how it did to some extent. He said he thought he was doing a pretty good job managing this thing, but it was a distraction, no doubt about it. And as he said, it was a hoax. It prompts me to say, you know, as with China, the Democrats lied in trying to impeach him, and people have died as a result. So talk a little bit about that particular factor in all of this, if you would, quickly.
Sure. Well, you know, you've stated it very well. That wasn't all absorbed. I think all of us were distracted by impeachment. That was the only news of the day, just as coronavirus is the news of the day today. But I would also add, you know, and we talked about this last week, you had the WHO also, not the rock group, but the World Health Organization, also making these very comforting noises about coronavirus in January during the same impeachment period, telling the world there's no human-to-human transmission, and indeed hammering the notion that there should be no travel bans put on China. I think that, and I would say that even as much as I like to excoriate, and they deserve, the Democratic Party, I would put it to this World Health Establishment, which of course, you know, Dr. Fauci is a part of, in the sense of being part of this global health effort to essentially control world health through these sorts of international bodies.
Diana, this is a subject to which we're going to have to return next week. Thank you for your time this week and for all that you do at dianawest.net and beyond. Keep it up. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.